probe dark matter. So we heard a great talk this morning by Mirangela. And I'm actually talking about something different from what she was talking about. She was talking about probing the local distribution of dark matter. But I want to talk about how we can measure its properties. And in particular, using a new technique of ultra-high resolution CMB lensing. So this work started actually with Nam, who was a master's student at PI, not at the time, but subsequently, and also Matthew, who's right there. He's a postdoc at PI, so already start a lot of PI connections originally. And there's two white papers that describe some of this stuff, a science white paper and a project white paper. So I don't need to tell this audience, we've got a lot of overwhelming evidence for dark matter, the strongest of which is coming from the cosmic microwave background. And while we know it's there, all of our information so far has come from gravitational interactions, and standard model interactions are tightly constrained. But needless to say, we all want to know what it is, what this dark matter is. So the model that we have, this cold collisionless dark matter model, passes lots of tests. But when you go to a variety of dark matter meetings, especially one lots of astronomers are in the room, you'll hear about all of these challenges that the dark matter model has. And they're all given this umbrella name called small-scale crisis of cold dark matter. And to give you an example of one of these crises that's been around for a while, here's a picture of a dark matter simulation. It's a Milky Way halo. It's all dark matter. The Milky Way itself would just sit in the middle here, the small little bit. But all these other clumps over here are supposed to be all these dark matter subhalos that we're supposed to see. And that's what cold dark matter predicts. And then when we go out and we make the measurements, we'll measure something like this. And these are halos at smaller masses, and we'll see some deficiency between what we predict and what we measure. And there are then lots of ways to resolve this. So you can go down the astrophysics route and say, well, these low mass halos aren't supposed to form stars, so we don't see them. So all these dark matter clumps are there, but we haven't identified them. And then theorists will go down the route of making alternate models like warm dark matter, self-interacting fuzzy dark matter. So I've been to many dark matter conferences, and the questions always come up. So CDM works very well on scales larger than 10 kiloparsecs, but seems to have issues on scales below 10 kiloparsecs. And the whole list of problems is, one, where are all the extra dark matter satellites? CDM predicts cusps. Do we see cores instead? Are there halos like the Large Magellanic Cloud, or Draco, that are so big that they're supposed to form stars, but why don't we see more of them? Cold dark matter simulations say we should see a lot more Dracos, which is a big dwarf galaxy in the Milky Way, and we don't see many. And you can't invoke this, well, star formation doesn't work argument, because they should have formed stars. So that's this.
Sorry, that isn't true, right? You know. So we see that there are, you know, galaxies that are, so halos whose masses are comparable to like LMC, whose stellar masses are like orders of magnitude smaller than LMC. So for example, these galaxies called ultra-diffuse galaxies, right?
And so we know
that there are big halos that do fail.
So you would argue there's no more too big to fail problem.
Well, too big to fail problem, I think, isn't quite.
Well, that was originally sad. What it was. So we should see more Dracos, and we can't invoke that star formation is quenched because they're too big and we should have seen the star. That was originally.
Yeah, but empirically, we do know that massive halos have a huge range in
Right. So what Neil is referring to is that we can add this to the list of weirdo things that are happening, but there's this new, apparently new, some would argue that it's not new because Fornax is low in dark matter as well, but there seem to be these diffuse galaxies that seem to be deficient in dark matter. So we can add this to the list of weird things, and why those are there is a question. Okay. And then and another question is whether we just have too much diversity, whether all of these subhalos we're measuring, they don't seem, you know, some are cores, some are cuffs. They don't seem to fit a consistent picture of either a one given baryonic model or one given dark matter model. So is there too much diversity going on? And what seems to then be what these conferences devolve into is, well, what the data is actually doing on scales below 10 kiloparsecs is just not always conclusive. And, you know, arguments go on about whether you trust this data set or that data set. So the question that I was trying to answer is, well, what do dark matter fluctuations look like on small scales? And is there a clean way to just measure that in a way that will make everybody happy? So, since I often give this talk to particle physicists, I would like to just give you a sense of what are the techniques that people use, what are some of their challenges, and what, at least for me, motivated trying to find an alternate way with some different systematics. So one way is sort of the first order thing you would do, which is you'd look for lots of dwarf galaxies in the Milky Way. But as we said, for dwarf galaxies below, say, 10 to the 8 solar masses, there's no need for them to form stars. And different astrophysics prescriptions will tell you different things. So all of those halos may very well be dark. And going in DES data or LSST data and just trying to count up all the dwarfs may not do the trick. There are some other techniques, for example, using a big galaxy cluster and trying to look for high redshift galaxies behind it. And some challenges there are the redshifts of those background galaxies, what your survey selection is, et cetera. I mean, all promising techniques, but with challenges. My own colleagues next door to me have tried to use high redshift gamma ray bursts, but there you need to know the host of the halo to make inferences on warm dark matter. And we've heard a bit, and it's sort of catching on because of the Gaia data of tidal streams. And there, what people are trying to do, and it's a promising technique, is to look for clumping in the streams to measure dark matter halos. And there are challenges. Usually, the clumping is dominated by a most massive halo. And if the stream, for example, goes through the baryonic disk, there can be giant molecular clouds. Even in the halo, there can be globular clusters. So one needs to be careful about disentangling all that. Now, the Lyman Alpha Forest has so far seemed to give the most powerful constraints on alternate dark matter models. But criticisms that have been invoked are that the neutral hydrogen itself, see, you're using still baryons to probe the dark matter, and the neutral hydrogen itself may have some spatial structure on small scales that's not traced by the dark matter itself. So you can see right away that all these techniques are using baryons in some way to probe the dark matter, which, you know, if you're a particle physicist, you would probably say is inherently problematic. And what I think is a very, very promising technique is to then forget about the baryons and just use gravitational lensing. So people have been using, as people in this room, galaxy-galaxy strong lensing, where you take a background galaxy and you look how it's been gravitationally lensed by foreground galaxy. And you can do this in optical and millimeter wavelengths. And one complexity is that there is a covariance between complexity of the background galaxy and the structure that you're trying to see. So I can add more complexity to the background galaxy, and that's hard to disentangle it from the substructure I'm trying to see in the lensing galaxy. So it becomes a challenge. And so to avoid some of these systematics, I'm suggesting a different technique. It, of course, will have its own systematics, which we will discuss towards the end. But what I'm suggesting is to use gravitational lensing. So gravitational lensing is nice and clean, and we don't use baryonic tracers. But of the microwave background, and using the microwave background itself as a backlight instead of, say, galaxies. So CMB lensing, as we call it, is just the bending of the CMB by foreground structure. And I say traditionally it's been used to probe large-scale structure. The first direct detection of CMB lensing was in 2014, or earlier, by Kendrick, indirectly, Kendrick and company. So it's relatively recent technique, but it's been used to probe large scales. And only recently has it been used to measure halo size objects, like Milky Way size objects, or actually larger, 10 to the 13 solar masses. And actually, that was work led by Matt, who's sitting here, in 2015 using ACT data, where we stacked 12,000 CMAS galaxies in ACT data and measured the gravitational lensing around those galaxies of the CMB. But what I'm talking about now, in order to probe dark matter particle properties, is measuring halos with masses below like 10 to the 9, so even smaller than what we've achieved so far. And before I go into the detail, let me just outline the advantages of using CMB lensing to probe small-scale structure. So one, it's gravitational lensing, so we love that. But the other is that I know the redshift of the backlight. One of the challenges with anybody who's working in optical lensing will tell you is just photo Z errors and not knowing the redshift of your backlight, and that causes all sorts of problems. But the CMB, we know it's at redshift of 1100, and we also know the properties of the backlight very, very well. So there's no question about, well, what's the shape of the background galaxies, et cetera. And in fact, on these small scales that we're talking about, we don't even have primordial fluctuations in the CMB anymore. What you should imagine in your head in these small scales is that we're just talking about a smooth gradient. Maybe just imagine going from red to blue in a little square, and that's it. There are no primordial fluctuations anymore. So that's actually perfect for lensing. That's exactly, you know, if you're a lenser, exactly what you would want is a backlight where you know the redshift and you knew the properties and it was just a clean gradient, for example. And then another bonus feature is that because the CMB is so far away, a redshift of 1100, it's sensitive to all of the intervening matter. And because of the volume factor, most of the matter it's sensitive to is between redshifts 1 and 3. And if you're trying to probe, so your structure grows hierarchically, so if you're trying to see if there's a deficiency of small scale halos, you actually have more sensitivity to alternate dark matter models if you probe higher redshifts, right? Because at higher redshifts, the contrast between cold dark matter and warm dark matter should be larger. So now let's talk about the observable that we're trying to measure. So it's basically this line here. And what this is just your dark matter map projected in 2D, and then the Fourier transform, and then I'm measuring the power on different scales. So just to break that down, all I'm doing is I'm taking my matter power spectrum, my cold dark matter, or my dark matter power spectrum, my matter power spectrum, and I'm multiplying it by just some distance factors. These are co-moving distance factors, and I'm just integrating from today to the last scattering surface, and that's it. And then I multiply by some L factors, and then I get my curve here. So it's literally you take your dark matter map, project it, so it's in 2D, and now I'm measuring the power of that projected dark matter map on different scales, large scales to small scales. That's it. It's just the power of my dark matter map. So far, when I say we've measured large scales, what I mean is we've measured L's out to, say, 2,000, 3,000 with CMB experiments so far. And what I'm talking about measuring is L's an order of magnitude farther out to about 30,000. And that's the scales you need to start probing K's of, say, 7 inverse megaparsec and halos below 10 to the 9. So that's what you want to measure. And as I said, I'm showing here a breakdown of all of the structure in different redshift bins that got added up to make that solid black curve. And you can see out here, it's largely structures between redshift 1 and 2 and 3 over here that's contributing to that solid curve. So as I said, that gives you a little bit more of a lever arm on these alternative models. So what are we actually looking for? So here I'm plotting that same curve, but I'm showing you the fractional difference of that curve with respect to cold dark matter. So I'm telling you how much the power should be suppressed on small scales, and you see it's about a 20% suppression of power at these small scales. So that's the signal that we're looking for. Do we see any suppression in power that deviates from the CDM, the naive CDM prediction? This is the nonlinear power spectrum.
It's a model for the nonlinear power
spectrum. Well, we use the warm and fuzzy code by Dottie Marsh, and it falls in the nonlinear. So you don't, if you were just using the linear power spectrum, it'd be a huge effect. So don't use that.
So but, it's a model for the nonlinear power spectrum.
Yeah, it assumes a model for the nonlinear power spectrum.
Which is like extrapolated from larger scales and these small scales.
It's one of these standard, I think it's one of these standard models that you'll find in like CAM or whatever. I forget which one, I'd have to look in one of them, yeah. But it's just a standard. When you have CAM, you have a variety of these models.
Okay, I guess the other question is, what about baryonic effects?
Thank you, perfect. So even though I told you that we are measuring the dark matter directly and not using baryonic tracers, that doesn't mean that baryons and their impact can't move around where the matter is. Of course they can. So here is a simulation, I think it was from the OWL simulation, where they added cold dark matter and baryons, and you see what happens is also suppression of the power, but with a different shape. And so the idea is that if you measure the shape of this matter power spectrum very precisely, then you can distinguish what's going on if you see a suppression from naive CDF. Yes.
But would that really look different from warm dark matter versus baryons?
Well, what actually it would look like is that you would see this suppression from baryons, and you would then see another suppression on top of it, right, in a different direction. So originally I thought, I have to distinguish between these two curves, but that's not really the case. You always have baryons. So I would be having some suppression, and then I would see an enhanced suppression beyond that if I had warm dark matter. But as you will see at my last slide, this is work in progress to distinguish exactly how well I can tell the difference given a set of measurements. So scenario one, you make this measurement, you see no deviation from just pure cold dark matter with no baryons, and that's great. You've constrained your dark matter models, you've also constrained your baryonic models. And then case number two, you see some significant deviation, and then the hope is that you've got a lever arm with the shape to tell the difference of what's going on. So one thing that you may worry about is, well, you may recall that CMB lensing, so this is a plot from the CMBS4 science book, one of its claims to fame is that it's supposed to be really good at measuring the neutrino mass. So this is the same projected dark matter curve that I've taken the Fourier transform of. But now I've plotted it the way it changes when I dial up the mass of the neutrinos. So dialing up the mass of the neutrinos actually lowers the amplitude of this dark matter power spectrum. And that's why measuring this so precisely is one of the ways that CMB experiments hope to constrain the mass of the neutrinos. But what you'll notice is that we're still talking about relatively large scales here, and then these curves flatten out. And what we're talking about for probing dark matter properties is measuring way out here, L's of say 20,000 as opposed to 3,000. And so luckily, because there's this long flattening You've got this large lever arm here, and then you're looking for suppression, and it turns out there's no degeneracy between your dark matter particle properties and the neutrino mass, which we just checked explicitly. So there's no covariance between the two, and you can still measure both separately because you're just using very different parts of the power spectrum. Okay, so what kind of experiment do you need to make, you know, to look for this kind of deviation? So I'm plotting the same curve again here. And well, it turns out, so initially I tried to see if I could repurpose some large dish radio telescopes to make this measurement, but you can't because you need so much sensitivity. So to look, for example, to see, say, an 8 sigma, at the 8 sigma level, a deviation from cold dark matter, whatever it's due to, baryons or alternate dark matter model, would require actually a camera 3 times more sensitive than CMBS-4 and with 5 times better resolution. So if you don't know, CMBS-4, it's a 6-meter dish. It has a resolution of about 1.5 arc minutes. And what you'd need is basically a 30-meter dish with a resolution of about 15 arc seconds.
Sorry, so when this plots, you know, so for these theory curves, are you holding fixed, like the baryon mode, or?
I'm just saying to see a deviation at, say, at 8 sigma, or roughly 10 sigma, mm-hmm. What kind of instrument would
deviation,
I need?
Deviation, though?
From naive CDM with no baryons.
With no baryons.
Sure. Or, I mean, I can add baryons to this and look for a deviation from that. I could as well.
Yeah, but the uncertainty in that prediction is like...
Well, I'm just... Right. So right now, I'm just saying, what do I need to make any kind, this kind of measurement away from naive CDM?
But naive CDM,
So let's discuss this more at the end when we're going to discuss interpretation, because I know you're very worried about, well, how do I interpret the measurement? But right now I'm just focused on how do I make a clean measurement of the matter power spectrum? That's it. Okay, so what do I require to do that?
I actually don't think baryons are a big deal breaker. If you combine with other measurements, you can make the CMB, for example, you can measure
absolutely
most of that baryon suppression at very high signal to noise with the PSE, for example.
Right.
So this is to
measure what exactly?
To measure the PGE term, the galaxy electron term, which is like
I don't need the PGE term, so I need the effect of baryons on the dark matter.
So that's actually, so the big 20% effect, most of that is coming from just the fact that you have gas. There's the puffiness of the gas profile. So there's a smaller part
in certain models, and there's other models.
I understand what Matt is trying to get at, so let me get more to the punchline, because what he's trying to get at is this data set is so rich and there's so much redundancy because you also map out where all the gas is. So we have lots of lever arms actually. But let me just tell you. We'll get there. We'll get there. Lots to discuss. Lots to discuss. In fact, we have a whole workshop in Aspen that you're all welcome to discuss all of this stuff. But the point is, I really did try to repurpose existing telescopes. I tried really hard, but this really does require a new instrument. And what it requires to make this kind of measurement is, first of all, you want to be situated in the Atacama Desert because you want to actually be able to map as much sky as possible, right? So when you're in the Atacama Desert, you can get about 50% of the sky. And what it also requires is 2 30-meter millimeter wave telescopes. And the reason why is because you need so many detectors. For reference, CMBS-4 is 500,000 detectors. This requires 2.4 million detectors. But each of these detectors, you can pack 4 on a pixel. So we're talking about 600,000 pixels, 300,000 each on one of these 30-meter telescopes. And that gives you total sensitivity 3 times deeper than CMBS-4, and we call this CMB-HD. So now you say, which is what we're getting to with this discussion, well, if I have such a super duper CMB experiment, what else can I do with it, right? I mean, you don't want to just build something just for one thing. So I talked about measuring the small scale matter power spectrum really well, and that's my main goal. But one of the key science goals is actually measuring an effective very, very well, and that's also ties into dark matter physics. So I'll talk about that more in the next slide. But of course, you don't lose any science that you can do with CMBS-4. You can add small aperture telescopes and still get the same sensitivity to primordial gravitational waves, neutrino mass, et cetera. But some of the key things to point out that open a whole new frontier of astrophysics are mapping the gas with the thermal SC effect to much higher resolution than we've ever been able to do before, 15 arc seconds at 150 gigahertz, and also mapping the KSC effect, which we'll hear about more later. And so for people who are interested in galaxy formation, all of this is extremely important to pin down various baryonic feedback models. But another really cool thing is that this type of instrument can give you a whole census of the dwarf planets in our outer solar system. And the reason why is because traditionally we've looked for planets by looking at reflected light from the sun. But when you go farther out into the outer solar system, you can't see that reflected light, it drops off. But these objects, dwarf planets and also these mystery Planet Nine objects, have internal heat, and you can see that in the millimeter wave. So this becomes a very effective way of mapping out a region of our solar system that optical surveys can't do. And then in addition, all of these maps, we can basically survey half the sky once a day with about a daily cadence. So now we can see all sorts of time-varying phenomena, even co-locating transient events with gravitational wave events, et cetera, and measuring their polarization, because all of this will have polarization information. That can tell you about jet properties, and for people who love black holes, that's of interest. And then, of course, there's lots of synergies with optical lensing surveys. And then I want to emphasize there's a whole host of novel ideas that I haven't even discussed, but such sensitive high-resolution observations just really open the door to new things that you can do.
So, sorry, I think I missed something you mentioned. I just forgot. So you said this is better than CMBS-4?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's like CMBS-5 or?
Well, let's call it HD so we don't give it a number. But the numbers to take away are 3 times more sensitive and 5 times better resolution over the same 50% of the sky.
But you don't want to do it from a space.
Oh, no, because it's too big a dish. So you can't put a 30-meter dish in space. So
okay.
So this is something, you know, unlike S4, where some of its science can be done from space, this is something that really needs to be done from the ground. The disadvantage, though, is that you can't get some of the higher frequency channels that you would really like, but you can't get this resolution from space.
Is there a simple way to summarize what the expected relative cost or time or difficulty is relative to S4?
Yeah, so CMBS-4 costs $700 million. In DOE dollars, and I'm told DOE dollars are a scaled up price, but let's take it at face value. So then CMBHD costs double, basically, double CMBS-4. It will do everything that S4 can do plus more, and then if the small aperture telescopes of CMBS-4 cost $300 million. So if you wanted to add an additional $300 million of those same S4 18 small aperture telescopes, you can stick them in the South Pole, then you can do all the S4 science, including primordial gravity waves, to that same 5 × 10⁻⁴ target. And this can do all the delensing.
And is a 30-millimeter wave dish, is that considered futuristic technology, or is that something
people think? No. So we did have a workshop. I had a whole panel of instrumentalists, and nobody thought that 30 meters was crazy. It was challenging, but none of the instrumentalists said that they thought there were any showstoppers. I think when you start talking 50 meters, that's what starts scaring people. I also want to mention, so I said this is double S4, so that means we're talking about the 1.5 billion range. 1 billion of that is just the detector cost. And there are a number of avenues that can lower that cost. So for example, Well, for example, mass production, once Simons Observatory, for example, starts asking for 30,000 detectors, the cost could drop. But another avenue is potentially using MKIDs. So they're being tested on Sky Now, at the LMT, their proposals test them at the GBT. And if they work, they're far cheaper than TES detectors. So the cost could drop by factors of 2 or 3. So we definitely want to see what happens in 5 years with the technology. Okay. So so the science was outlined in a decadal white paper, and the project, this whole CMBHD project, was submitted to the decadal a few months ago. But I want to get back to an effective, because I think that's a key science goal of HD. So the target for an effective of CMBHD is this 0.014, which is basically twice as good as CMBS4. And I want to stress, because sometimes it gets lost because I'm talking about small scales, but CMBHD will actually will basically measure all of this CMB power spectrum. So this is TT, TE, EE in the B mode. This is the B mode lensing here. And it will measure it from L of 30 out to, say, 30,000, 40,000. And the reason why I say that is actually CMBHD itself actually only needs to measure from about 1,000 onwards to, say, 30,000. But we have already funded experiments like the Simons Observatory that are going after this region from 30 to 1,000. There's no gap here. In fact, the Simons Observatory will already be measuring TTTE and EE out to 2,000 to the cosmic variance limit. So there's absolutely no reason for a ground-based CMB experiment beyond Simons Observatory to be remeasuring this region, because it will already be measured as good as possible by the Simons Observatory. And so with that combination, HD will have measurements from 30 all the way out to 30,000. Only 1,000 in the B modes, and that's what gives that tight and effective constraint. So the reason why this N effective is important, so this is the change in N effective away from the standard model value. So the standard model predicts that 3.046 number, that there are roughly 3 active neutrinos. This is basically time. So this is towards the Big Bang, and this is today. This is like temperature. And any time you have a new particle, a new light particle, so a particle less than about 0.1 eV in the universe, that's in equilibrium with the standard model, it needs to change an effective by at least this number, 0.027. So if you can rule out any change in an effective at the 2 sigma level down to this level here, down to 0.027, which HD can, that means that you're basically saying there are no additional light thermal particles in the universe. And the reason why that's important for dark matter models is many dark matter models, like axion models, predict a light thermal counterpart. So ruling that out actually rules out wide classes of models. And unfortunately, so our current limit is here these will of course be interesting constraints, but if you look in terms of temperature, the regime that S4 will be probing, it's not a big regime, but with CMBHD, you can go all the way out to here. So because I'm going to be asked anyway, I might as well show you my backup slides right here, which is you're going to ask me, what about foregrounds? Foregrounds are the main systematic for HD. And the reason why they're an issue, so we've got lots of astrophysical foregrounds. We have galaxies that emit in the radio and also in the infrared. We have the thermal SZ signal from all the gas, and there's galactic dust and synchrotron. And you might say, well, why are you worrying about this? You heard that CMBS4 has polarization and is going to rely on its polarization measurements. But for this small-scale lensing that we're talking about, most of the signal-to-noise is actually from the temperature data. And so you have to worry about these foregrounds. And so to give you a sense of what these foregrounds look like, in black, it's hidden under here, that's this primordial CMB. And then here I'm showing you some foreground. So we'll hear a talk after about the KSZ. So this is just to prep that talk. This is the kinetic SZ. It's basically from the motion of gas from early times during reionization. And then if I add to that the effect from the late times, so galaxy motion, then I get the green curve. And you can see that green curve is above this noise in red. That's the noise that we're targeting with HD. It's about a half a microkay arc minute at 150 gigahertz. So that's already a source of added noise. But the biggest worry is what I have here in blue, and that's these galaxies that emit in the infrared. I should mention HD will be a fantastic galaxy catalog. So I neglect to say that. But for us, we want to remove that. So what I need to do is remove all of these infrared galaxies to this flux level in order to get their power to be below the instrument noise. And the way that I do that is that all the galaxy foregrounds, so the radio and infrared galaxies, the thermal SZ, and even the galactic dust, they're frequency dependent, but the CMB is not. So CMB HD will have 7 different frequency channels to clean out these foregrounds. But in addition, what helps you is the high resolution. So because CMB HD has such a big dish, all these galaxies, they look like point sources. And when you increase the size of the dish, the point sources get brighter and brighter, even though I don't add more detectors. So that allows me to identify these sources and template subtract them from my maps down to very low flux limit. So the combination of the big dish and the multi-frequency channels helps me. But now to get into some more technical details of things you can do, when I make these lensing maps, I have 2 maps that I'm sort of cross-correlating together. And you can imagine what I've got is I got a large-scale map that just looks like the background gradient. And then I've got a small-scale map, which has my structure in it. And I'm basically trying to see how that structure has messed up my background gradient in the process of gravitational lensing. That's basically what I'm trying to do. But there are very different scales involved. So I don't need to have overlapping scales in these 2 maps. I can throw out all scales above 2,000 in one map and all scales below 5,000 in another map and not lose any signal to noise. So that means I won't have correlated foregrounds in the 2 maps. And I'll still have noise in my small scale map. In the large scale map, actually, even Simon's Observatory is measuring, so this is for experts, but even Simon's Observatory is measuring the signal to such low noise that even if I eat up sensitivity by deprojecting foregrounds, I'm still measuring to the cosmic variance limit. You don't even lose anything there. But I'll still have noise in my small scale map, largely just Poisson fluctuations, and there I'm going to use my big dish. And so here I'm showing you how my ability to remove sources down to lower and lower flux limits gets better when my dish size gets bigger. So here we're talking about a 30-meter dish. And I find my sources at 1 high frequency. I assume an SED, which of course is an assumption. I subtract them with a lower frequency, down to a lower frequency, knowing the shape of my beam. And then I'm going to have some residual because I don't know the spectral energy distribution of my sources. And then I bring in my ILC cleaning. So that's the detailed picture of what one can do. And of course, it needs to be demonstrated with simulations. But then you will ask, well, but the KSC doesn't have a frequency dependent. So what am I going to do there? Well, so one neat thing that I thank Kendrick for pointing out to me is that the KSC is not going to cause you any bias in your signal because actually the lensing signal is aligned with the direction of the gradient of my CMB map, and the KSC signal is not. And work has been done actually by a number of Canadians, Renee Holsek, working with students at Toronto, has been exploring this. But I still have noise, even though I don't have bias, I'll still have noise from this green curve. And while it's not critical to remove it, it would certainly help my signal to noise. And I'm not going to say anything more about this, except that I expect great things to come out of perimeter in the near future. And if not, I'll get my own students to work on it. But, And then the reionization case, it actually gives you basically no degradation in your signal to noise. So we don't even worry about removing that. So removing this signal, I would definitely say, so definitely what the two things that worry me and what I want my own students to demonstrate with simulations is getting the CIB to low enough noise levels and removing the KSE would be a nice bonus. Okay, perfect. So then the question will be, well, but what do I learn from such a measurement? And that I've already touched on this, and I'm sure I'll have more discussions. But so again, my objective is just to make a clean measurement of the matter power spectrum. But we did talk about baryons also changing the shape of the matter power spectrum. And one thing that I didn't appreciate until relatively recently is that this shape that I'm showing from the OWL simulation, I actually thought the shape could be anything. But a whole bunch of hydro simulations seem to have a similar shape, which some papers argue, and I have not verified yet, that can be parametrized by actually only even two parameters. So the idea is just to throw this in the mix in your likelihood code and parameterize this with two parameters and then add your model, check your chi squared. But still to be demonstrated with students and simulations, et cetera. So to summarize, just the key question I'm trying to answer is what do matter fluctuations look like on small scales? And is there a technique with different systematics? There are multiple techniques. People should pursue the techniques, especially if you're using current data, go for it. All the techniques have different systematics, and I think this could be a potentially powerful, clean technique as well. It does require 230-meter telescopes with a sensitivity three times better than CMBS-4. But once you have such an instrument, it actually opens a whole new frontier of millimeter wave observations and a whole new set of things you can think about if you had such data. So it's good motivation for an idea called CMBHD. There's white papers that have been submitted. There's a collaboration. We have a Slack channel. Anybody can join. Just email me. That's it.
I was just wondering if you had some intuition for the shape that you're seeing in CMB plus baryon.
Oh, like why it's there?
Yeah, like what exactly is setting that shape?
Right. These papers actually go into it. So, but my understanding is that basically what baryons do on a fundamental level is sort of blow out matter from one radius to another. And so if you ask what baryons can do, they sort of just move matter from here to here. And so they're suppressing power at some scales. I think some people feel the rise may be like an artifact of simulations, but basically they're moving power from some scales and shifting it out to larger scales.
So presumably then it would be dependent on the feedback mechanism.
Right. So all these simulations have completely different feedback mechanisms. And that's what I'm saying was surprising to me. I expected the curve to just be all over the place, but they all seem to have a similar behavior. And now what Matt was getting at is that what constrains this behavior and the depth of this curve are gas physics parameters. And so when you have this data, you also measure the gas physics because we've got the TSC. So those same parameters that we measure then go into constraining these models. So we have a lot more handles than I'm actually saying. Right.
Besides the gas, there's also like stars. So this rise at very high K, very high L, is dominated by stars.
And I wouldn't.
The uncertainty in that is quite.
I wouldn't worry about this rise up here because my noise is going to dominate.
But I can show you examples of other simulations that produce simulations whose effect from the baryons is is a rise as opposed to a dip. You know, even that can have time.
Right, but the point that we're trying to make is I will also have the gas profiles directly measured, right, with 15 arc second resolution. And I can stack many halos as well and see what the gas is doing in constraint. There are only like a few critical parameters that go into all
so
of these models.
Part,
right.
Right. Plus the part that I'm somewhat.
No. Oh, yeah, no, and
so
I agree.
There's only
right.
two
parameters. I agree.
It seems wildly optimistic, right? You know?
Right?
A more systematic approach, I think, might be just to look at the range of EFT parameters that are significant on these scales.
Right.
And the number of those parameters, you know, explodes as you move towards higher K.
But in terms of hydro models, though, what the curves seem to be doing.
With these specific simulations.
Okay, so. Right.
So what I'm saying is that there's other simulations.
Right.
That excite other kinds of templates.
So what I would, but again, what I'd argue is I'm coming at this from a measurement approach. So if I measure the matter power spectrum cleanly, which is all I'm claiming to try and do, I constrain all of that, right? I constrain those models.
The combination
right?
of all these different
right.
you know, bias terms is being constrained.
Sure, sure.
And so now to relate that now to the primordial dark matter linear power spectrum is extremely challenging.
It depends. It may be not. We may have models that are like this, and then we see a suppression that's just on top of this, an additional suppression, potentially. But all I'm saying is, let's just make a clean measurement, because we'll never know if we don't. Right.
Okay. Any other questions? You can also take some of the speaker.